Thank you, Bernie.
Right. I think I need to mention a welcome to somebody who's here and a sorry you're not here to somebody who isn't. Welcome, Katerina, to your first live Bible stream. And David, our esteemed leader, unfortunately, has got a job, which is great news, but it means that he's now in Cambridge. He will be carrying on. He'll be coming home at weekends for the time being to keep watching us and keeping us on the straight and narrow. So it's been a bit of a rush, as Bernie says, quite a long lead up as well that's kind of interrupted a bit. But I hope that tonight we'll really understand something about why this book, these two books, or three books with Ezra, are there. You might understand why Ezra's there, but why Chronicles? I'll start off by saying 1 and 2 Chronicles, just like the books of Samuel's and Kings, they are one book. It's just that they were written on two scrolls. So it is the book of Chronicles. And I'm putting it together with Ezra because originally Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah were treated as one scripture, one book. Ezra is credited with supposedly writing them all, but we don't know. That's just tradition. And Nehemiah's been covered in Bible Stream before. So it was good to include Ezra because in many ways there isn't a lot in Ezra when we're doing a quick overview as we tend to do in Bible Stream. If you've read 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, you'll probably think, why is it repeating what I've already read? If you're working your way through the Bible, there's so many bits in Chronicles that you've already read from Samuel and Kings. Well, Chronicles is placed after 1 and 2 Kings in the Bible, because obviously that's where it fits naturally. But actually, it was written at the very end of the Old Testament times. It was written around 400 BC. It was after the exiles had all returned. And that tells us something about why Chronicles is written the way it is, and what's in there, and also what isn't. So, we need to understand, I think, where the people of Israel are as a society at this time when Chronicles was written. They've been in exile, and when you think about it, a lot of the, all of the people would not have actually been exiled from Israel, from Judah, I should say, because Israel is what we normally call the northern kingdoms. But they were children and grandchildren. So the history of Israel is disconnected from them because they've been in Babylon, born and raised in Babylon. So I think we need to get a grasp of the history of the nation up to this point. And because I often get confused as to, well, was it Assyria, the Babylonians? Who was it who exiled the people, and who was this, and what time did that happen? I'm going to give us a kind of a quick overview of 500-600 years so that we can grasp what's going on in Chronicles. So I've got just a handful of slides to help us with this so that graphically we may be able to remember a bit more and grasp a bit more about what I'm saying. Okay, if we start at 1000 BC with King David, he brings all the 12 tribes together, makes them into a powerful nation of Israel. He's followed 50 years later by Solomon, who builds on his father's wealth and the stability of Israel for most of his life. And although Chronicles typically fails to mention it, he didn't do so well at the end of his reign. When his son Rehoboam takes over, the northern kingdoms rebel, And we have this split between the 10 northern tribes called Israel and Judah and Benjamin that are normally referred to as Judah. The northern kingdom comes to an end in 722 BC. This is when Assyria is the dominant power in the region, and they destroy Israel. They scatter the people. They exile the 10 northern tribes to various places. They're not taken to one place, but lots of different ones. And there's a deliberate policy to bring other people groups in. And this explains to quite a degree why in Jesus' time Samaria was so different, because it had this mix of other people groups which Judah didn't. We then have a bit more time, 130 years, it says here. Yeah. When Babylon comes into power, and unfortunately Judah upsets them a bit too much. They keep trying to rebel, don't want to pay their dues. And Judah is taken into captivity. So, we're now going to have another chronology. So we're starting 722, destruction of Israel and its exile. And then we have 586, when Jerusalem is destroyed by Babylon, and they completely destroy the temple as well. Everything that Judah stands for is destroyed. Now, there's an interesting little thing here which I hadn't realized, that there were three occasions when people were exiled, and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was the third time people were exiled. In the first one, Daniel went. And so the stories of Daniel start from this point, how long is it? 20 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. And that time is when, just out of interest, Ezekiel is prophesying. We then have a return. About 50 years after exile, a large number of Jews, about 50,000, come led by a guy called Zerubbabel, which is a Babylonian name because, of course, he was born in Babylon. But he's actually descendant of David. They start rebuilding the temple, but with a lot of opposition and a bit of apathy, it kept stopping until there was encouragement from Darius for them to finish it. And so in 516, we have the temple rebuilt, which interestingly is 70 years from the destruction of the temple to its rebuilding. And there were prophecies about 70 years. And when you look at the exile, you try and work out how does that fit in. But if you look at the temple, it's 70 years. And this is a time when we have Zechariah and Haggai prophesying. And we had Bernie last month doing Zechariah for us. So we're staying in the same time period in these two Bible teachings. It was another 15 years before... I haven't done Ezra, have I? No. We then have quite a long break before Ezra comes with some more people, and particularly a lot of the temple staff, the Levites, the priests, and the gatekeepers, and so on. And then about 15 years later, we have Nehemiah. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah were written before Chronicles. seems a bit strange. But Ezra was written and then Nehemiah about 10 years later, and probably 20, 30 years later, Chronicles was written. And originally, as I said, they were all one manuscript, one story. So I hope that helps us get an idea of the context of when Chronicles was written, and therefore why the history that's in Chronicles is not quite the same as in Kings and Samuel. How much identity did these returning exiles have? How much did they understand about their history? How did they feel about the land that they were coming back to, although to them it was a new place? We don't know how much the stories and the whole sense of being Jewish was carried through that time. Chronicles wants to emphasize the importance of not making the same mistakes that were made in the past, to trust and obey the God of Israel. So our chronicler was writing as a religious historian, not a political historian. His sources included the Book of the Kings of Israel and Judah, and many similar records which no longer survive, and some court records which also are all used in Samuel and Kings. He quotes from collections of the sayings of the prophets, some of which we know about: Samuel, Nathan, Gad is mentioned in Chronicles, and there's Iddo as well, not a well-known one. If you don't write a book in the Bible, you're not very well-known, are you? So although clearly concerned about the past, the writer cares less about what happened than about the meaning of what happened. He's an interpreter of the history, not a writer of history. So that's why you see so much of Samuel, 2 Samuel and Kings in Chronicles, word for word. And he seems to write from the point of view that he expects his readers to know what's in Samuel and Kings. There seems to be an expectation that they know the wider history, which is why he ignores a lot of it and adds other bits. He has a strong conviction that the key to the nation's prosperity lies in obedience to God. To disobey is to court disaster. And there are two other themes that run through Chronicles and Ezra. True worship focused on the temple, and the true kingship through the family line of David. These two themes come together in his account of David and Solomon, where he concentrates far more on the temple than on any other aspects of their reigns. At the heart of his account are God's promise to David of a lasting dynasty, and God's message to Solomon following his prayer at the dedication of the temple, where he receives the same promise and is warned to follow God's way. Because of this, the writer concentrates on the kings of David's line. He largely ignores the northern kingdoms, except where they encroach on Judah and Benjamin. And his introduction, which is loads of genealogies for 9 chapters, focuses on the southern tribes and the priestly tribe of Levi, which is the tribe that was specially dedicated to God's service. There are a few things we need to watch for if you're really looking closely when you're reading Chronicles, things that you might think seem a bit odd. Judah is often referred to as Israel. Although we call the 10 northern tribes Israel, Chronicler often calls Judah Israel. And his reason is, this is the true Israel. And it's also likely that when the kingdom split, that a lot of the people from the northern kingdoms did come south and stay loyal to the line of David. And particularly the Levites and the other priestly classes would have stayed in the south. Another issue is names. Since names were spoken, not written, there was no dictionaries, no reference as to how you spelt things. Some of them are written quite differently. So you may not realize who's being referred to. Some of these might be copying errors, but it's also common for them to have Hebrew names and a Persian or Babylonian name, and they get cross-referred to. And there are places where you think, what's he doing there? Surely that's the wrong time for that person. But that's because, particularly in the genealogies, there are names that are repeated, just like here. Lots of Johns, lots of Grahams. And, for example, in Ezra, there's a Nehemiah who goes back with him. But that's not the Nehemiah in the book of Nehemiah. It's just a different guy with the same name. And Kelubai, in going back to the genealogies, is actually Caleb. How would you know? So there are a few little things that can trip you up. The third key thing is that the writer tends to describe terms in the way that the returning people understood them, not the people at the time he's writing about. And it seems that particularly measurements and numbers had changed a bit, because his are different to Kings. And usually it's not random. Let's just say that way. It's not random difference, but there are differences. And we also have to remember, when it comes to the numbers, that it's more symbolic than it is mathematical. Because in those days, you know, when you wrote, numbers were symbolic. They weren't important as numbers. They were important in what they said. So if you wanted to glorify God, you increased the numbers of the conquering army or whatever. So it's probably time to actually whip through Chronicles and Ezra. So if you have your Bible, you might have to flick quite quickly as we go through. I'm just going to pick out key things. What's the first word in chapter 1? Adam. The beginning, the first man. That's symbolic. He starts in his genealogy going from Adam to Abraham. This is classic Jewish teaching, Jewish history. He then gives genealogies for all of Abraham's sons, not just Isaac. And he includes the people of Edom to show how they're related to Israel. Chapter 2, we have the line leading to David. Caleb is given a special importance because of his stand with Joshua in their report on the Promised Land. Chapter 3 is the line of David. Not just the kings, but the wider generations. Chapters 4 and 5, we have the descendants of Israel's other sons. Chapter 6, descendants of Levi and Aaron, given in more detail. And he also gives the lands that they occupied. He's beginning to bring in this idea of where they come from, where their roots are. Chapter 7, we go back to sons of Israel. Chapter 8, go into detail on the line of Benjamin and King Saul, who of course was a Benjamite. Going to read chapter 9, verse 1. All Israel was listed in the genealogies recorded in the book of the kings of Israel. The people of Judah were taken captive to Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. Now the first to resettle on their own property in their own towns were some Israelites, priests, Levites, and temple servants. Then there's a list of where people resettled. We're affirming the people's ancestry and their place in God's purposes, particularly from Abraham and Moses. When you hear this read out and you hear your family's name, you realize your place in this new, it's not a new kingdom, but it was a new nation. But a nation with a history. Chapter 9 finishes with a repeat of the genealogy of King Saul, because the beginning of chapter 10 starts with the death of King Saul. And it explains that it was because he was unfaithful to God, and that is why he was replaced by David. Chapter 11, we start the narrative about David, and that fills the rest of the book of 1 Chronicles. It's all David's story. You may notice there's no mention of David's life before he takes the command of the whole nation of Israel. Nothing about his hiding from Saul and being persecuted. Nothing about the difficulty he had in getting all the tribes together. But it does make a big point about his capture of the city of David, Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is so important in the life of the nation. Verses 10 onwards is a list of David's mighty men and some of their exploits. Again, the writers make a big thing about these people's ancestors, how much they have to be proud of. And in chapter 12, we have a description of the loyalty that David enjoyed, how much people appreciated him, valued him, were prepared to give to serve him. His full acceptance from every tribe of Israel. That probably wasn't quite accurate, but the point is made. David was popular, successful, and people wanted to serve him. Chapter 13, we have the story of David trying to bring the ark to Jerusalem. It seems to appear chronologically earlier than it actually happened, but that's not important. This is where Uzzah puts his hand out to steady the Ark of the Covenant and he dies. And that seems very harsh. You think, why would God do that? Well, it's not explicitly said here, but what you find is that they were trying to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem without following the instructions God had given for how the Ark was to be moved. It wasn't meant to be stuck on a cart with bullocks pulling it. And you certainly don't touch it. Chapter 14, we see David being blessed and successful in everything he does. And in chapters 15 and 16, we have the successful return of the ark to Jerusalem. Well, it's not return, is it? First time to Jerusalem. And if you look carefully in, is it chapter 15, verse 13? Or 16, verse 13? I'm not sure. David realizes his mistake beforehand, and this time he rectifies it. The ark is brought into Jerusalem, with the proper procedures, the proper people being carried on poles as was required. The move is successful. And David has a psalm for the occasion. Chapter 17. Here we see the writer showing David as being truly godly. He asks God before doing anything. He consults true prophets of God. And in this chapter, we have that key prophecy from Nathan, where he's told he cannot build the temple. He has blood on his hands. He has killed numerous people. He's been a fighter. But his son can build it. And his dynasty will last forever. When there's a prophecy that his dynasty will last forever, you have to think, well, humanly speaking, that can't happen. What nation, what empire has continued with the same family line? It hasn't. It's only in the Messiah that we can see that fulfillment. Chapters 18, 19 and 20. These chapters record David's successes in battle together with his right-hand man Joab. David is seen as merciful and he only responds to aggression from others. He's not going out conquering territory because he thinks he can or because he wants to capture nations. He's just protecting his borders. But these are the borders of the promised land. These encounters have been compressed into one account, but of course these are stories that are spread out over time in historical terms. Chapter 21, one of those oddities, it's actually the same as the account in Kings pretty much. It appears that David isn't trusting God for his army's strength. He decides to work out, to find out how many people he can call on, what their skills are and their abilities. And it appears that this is not trusting God. He repents, but it's too late. The people pay the price for his lack of faith. He's given a choice as to what punishment will come on his people. And he chooses an infection, basically. A black death. Something that kills a large number of the people. It's just like today, when our leaders make bad decisions, we pay the price. Currently, even literally, we pay the price. In verse 18, as part of his reparation for what he's done, the prophet Gad tells David to build an altar and tells him the site which he will use. It's a threshing floor. It's a place where grain is threshed. But this is actually what becomes the Temple Mount. It's the place where the temple will be built. At this point, it's just an altar for David to sacrifice on. This is one of those occasions where if you're incredibly well-learned, you'll notice that the name seems different in Kings and in Chronicles of the person who owns the threshing floor. But it is the same guy. It's a different spelling, a different pronunciation perhaps. I'm now going to jump chapters 22 to 29, all as one block. Because this is a whole section about the temple, the design of the temple, the preparations for it. Because according to the chronicler, David is the chief architect. He's the guy who's the genius behind the temple, how it's going to work, how it's going to be provided for, what it's going to look like, the organization behind it. Even though Solomon was the actual builder, it appears the ideas have come from David. It is an idealized picture of David. But this is where the writer is putting together his two key themes: David's line and the temple, the worship of God. From 29:30 to the end, we see David passing on the mantle of kingship, the responsibility for the temple, to Solomon. He's organized everything for the temple that Solomon is to build. We don't have anything in there about the issues with his sons, like Absalom, who were a little bit difficult and tried to take the throne. All the problems that David had in his personal life. The writer probably thinks, well, you can find out about that in Samuel and Kings. I don't need to write about that. This detail about the temple, providing for the materials, organizing the priests and Levites, probably happened when King David was still alive and Solomon was king, because there was a big overlap. Because of the problem David had with Absalom and then Adonijah, he had to quickly make Solomon king. He couldn't wait till he died, because then probably it would all fall apart and Solomon would not have been able to follow him as king. So this period when they were both reigning is probably when all these ideas about the temple came together. Chapters 28 and 29 are all about David handing over authority. And again, we get God's promises to David and Solomon. Follow me and your line will last forever. Chapter 29 particularly talks about David's gifts towards the cost of the temple. It's clear that David is extremely wealthy. When we hear about the wealth of Solomon, he was building on a very healthy bank balance already. Because of David's conquests, his fighting against so many other people who tried to invade, take over, he had a lot of spoils of war. And this helped provide for the trade that Solomon was able to undertake. So we finished 1 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, which is actually just the continuation of the story. This covers the period of Solomon all the way to the return of Israel from exile. In other words, it's 1 and 2 Kings plus a bit more, because it goes further on in time. Chapter 1. Solomon is at his best. He's doing the right thing. We have his famous request for wisdom, which God grants together with wealth and fame, which he didn't ask for. The peace that David's military strength had brought paid dividends in the trade that Israel was now able to carry out. In chapter 2, we have detail of what went into the temple and where it came from. You can see that Solomon is a very clever trader. And there are enormous amounts of oil being traded for cedar wood and things like that. And gold and precious stones would have come from an area that we consider to be Yemen nowadays. Chapters 3 and 4. We have the actual building of the temple, detail of what was put where, how much gold was used everywhere. Nothing cheap went into this temple. And it culminates in chapters 5 to 7 with the dedication of the temple. Chapter 5, verse 13 says, accompanied by trumpets, cymbals, and other instruments, they raised their voices in praise to the Lord and sang, He is good, His love endures forever. Then the temple of the Lord was filled with a cloud, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Chapter 6 continues the glory of the Lord, and we have Solomon's speech and long prayer asking for God's blessing on the temple. And interestingly, not just on the people of Israel, anyone who seeks God, because he says, God, you are trustworthy, your promises are true. In chapter 7, the writer of Chronicles has a response from God. Chapter 7, verse 17. As for you, if you walk before me as David your father did, do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with David your father when I said, you shall never fail to have a man to rule over Israel. But if you turn away and forsake the decrees and commands I've given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot Israel from my land which I've given them, and I will reject this temple I've consecrated for my name. I'll make it a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples. And though this temple is now so imposing, all who pass by will be appalled and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this people, this temple? The people will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, worshipping and serving them. That is why he brought all this disaster on them. This is the writer's emphasis. He's saying, here is the history. There is the warning. And you know what happened. And you know why it happened. Your forebears failed to obey God. They did follow other gods. And they suffered the consequences, which is why they were exiled and you were taken out of your land. Chapter 9 is about Solomon's glory and fame, the visit of the Queen of Sheba. We see his wealth, his trade. And very quickly, after 40 years' reign, he dies. So we don't have a lot of detail about Solomon and how he lived. And we have nothing about his hundreds of wives, concubines, and the way that he lost his way and followed other gods because he allowed his wives to continue with their gods and things started to fall apart. He started to tax his people too much. He became authoritarian. Chapters 10 to 36, the rest of 2 Chronicles, tells us basically the rest of the history of the nation. Solomon started well and finished badly. When the writer covers the rest of the kings through to exile, he hardly mentions the northern kingdom kings at all, because to him they're irrelevant. His focus is on Judah and Benjamin, the kingships who follow David's line. There tends to be new material on the kings who are obedient to God, and a lot less information on the ones who aren't. Where kings are disobedient to God, he clearly shows the consequences of them doing so. The writer wants the people to learn from the past. Whereas Kings ends with the people in exile, Chronicles, chapter 36, ends with the return from exile under Cyrus of the Persian Empire, as it was prophesied by Jeremiah. In fact, the last two verses of Chronicles are almost the same as the first two verses of Ezra. The only difference is that it stops mid-sentence. The second verse of chapter 1 of Ezra carries on. So, because the story continues, we're going to just touch on Ezra as well. So this book continues the story of the return of the exiles. Firstly, under Zerubbabel, as I mentioned before, who was a descendant of David, but did not take on a kingly role. He took a leadership role, but not a kingly role. Ezra comes a lot later, as I said before. And the emphases that are in Chronicles continue into this book. The importance of the people knowing where they've come from, the importance of the temple, and reinstating true worship of God. In chapter 1, you'll notice in verses 8 and 11, there's someone called Sheshbazzar, described as the prince of Judah. It seems most likely he was actually a Persian official in charge of the return of the exiles to represent the king and keep an eye on things. But the focus is on Zerubbabel, who is the Jew who brings the people back to Israel. Chapter 2, a bit like Chronicles, we have a list of returnee families. 70 verses in this chapter. And there's a special note in verse 70 about the priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, temple servants. The focus on the people who are returning is the temple. In chapter 3, the focus of the returnees is to reinstate the altar. That was a central part of worship. They needed to make sacrifices. They needed an altar. Then they started on rebuilding the temple. But this was not going to be the magnificent structure of Solomon's. They did not have the wealth. They did not have the wherewithal to make a temple anything like Solomon's temple. In chapters 4 and 5, we have a list of two major occasions when there was resistance to the rebuilding of the temple from the surrounding peoples, the powers that were in the land that were not Jewish. There was quite a separation between these two occasions. And you notice the first time, work is stopped. The king says no. These are rebellious people. We don't want them rebuilding their temple. But the second time, under Darius, I believe it is, the records say, yes, they can rebuild. And so they're given encouragement and funds to carry on the rebuilding of the temple. the temple is finished. I believe that was in 516 BC from my previous slides. And after its dedication, we have the reinstatement of the Passover feast. The Passover is such an important Jewish festival that had largely been ignored, forgotten about for centuries. So it's a key feast for the people to be celebrating. We have a big period of time passes, but it's not mentioned. Chapter 7, the return of Ezra. Ezra is a priest and a descendant of Aaron. So he has a very high status. This time we have King Artaxerxes of Persia, who's allowed Ezra to come with a large number of people. And the focus of the book of Ezra at this point is on the return of the priests and the temple staff. And so in chapter 8 we have another list of people returning. And interestingly, the tense of the writing changes to I. It seems as if Ezra is now writing this bit, or else the writer is quoting Ezra. So the focus is on staffing the temple, bringing valuable gifts to the temple. It seems that Ezra and the people brought a lot of valuables with them from Babylon, probably provided by other Jews who were still there. And I didn't mention it, but I think it showed it on my timeline, that in the period between these two returns, under Zerubbabel and Ezra, was the time when Esther had her moment. Chapters 9 and 10, the end of Ezra, it's another one of these rather awkward things, we'd rather weren't there. Ezra finds out that there's been significant intermarriage with other people groups, non-Jews. Some of the Levites, the priestly class, have been marrying non-Jews, which of course was forbidden under Mosaic law. Because of the importance of the purity of the people of Israel, these marriages should never have happened in the first place. So families are separated, wives and children abandoned. If you remember, a large reason for the fall of the Jewish people was the fact that they didn't completely remove the foreign peoples when they came into the promised land. There was still intermarrying that went on, which meant that all these other false gods became accepted by the leadership of the people. So it's important to keep the purity. And it's interesting that the next 400 years, Israel is always under the dominance of another power, whether it was the Greeks or the Romans, but they stayed loyal to God. They didn't have kings. It was the priestly class that held the power, that gave out justice. The writer of Chronicles and Ezra was so fixated on the line of David. How come there was no king over Israel in this period? During this time, the expectation of a Messiah developed, the understanding that the line of David would end in a Messiah, someone of his line who would make Israel great again, a priest-king who would fulfill the prophecies scattered throughout the scriptures. In Daniel 9:25, he's referred to as the Anointed One. So that's basically covering Chronicles and Ezra. I think you've heard enough from me for the moment. Over to Bernie, and we will take questions, which I will try to answer, or say we don't know, which is quite a valid point of view. Bernie.